A year or so ago, we talked with the author of a book that covered the history of the UW Arboretum, and it was great to get those insights into how it got started. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, and today we're going to find out what's going on at the Arboretum right now and how they help educate you and me about the value of and importance of native plants. Molly Fifield-Murray, our guest today, she is the Outreach and Education Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison, with us to talk about sustainable gardening and native plants. And Molly, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
It's good to be here.
Really, great fun to have you with us today. And there's sort of starting maybe on a little bit of a negative point, which is the emerald ash borer. And it's been a concern of the spread of it. Anything to keep in mind as it relates to our native trees?
Well, of course, ashes are native. Many of them have been selected, so they're cultivars of natives. The autumn purple ash was first selected from a tree near what we used to call the home ec building on campus here. By William Longenecker. And those have been planted quite a bit around the country, and we assume they will be just as susceptible to the ash borer as the white ash that it was cultivared from, if that's a word. So what we think is that, you know, the horse has already left the barn on this one. Because the ash borer is here, the ashes are doomed is what people in Michigan would tell us. There are people who will tell you you can put chemicals on them, but we're very concerned about those chemicals because they're systemic. They kill all insects, and they are the culprit of the incident that killed 25,000 bumblebees in one day at a parking lot where the landscape company had just had a contract to take care of the place, and they use this insecticide on the trees just as a preventative, apparently. But they use them on basswoods, which are pollinated by bees. So it's these chemicals that might be used to save your ash tree are very, very serious chemicals indeed to put into the environment. And if you put it on the ash tree, is it only going to be on the ash tree? Ashes are probably wind-pollinated for the most part. Wouldn't have bumblebees on them, but would have other insects. One other thing we learned from Bringing Nature Home book is that the reason that we plant native plants isn't just for the beauty of the plants, but for the services they provide to the rest of the environment. And if we want to eat fruits and vegetables, then we need bumblebees. And to have bumblebees, we need plants for them to get nectar and pollen from. And so what's happening, you know, sort of opposite of the emerald ash borer problem is orchards and other places who want pollination services from bumblebees planting native plants so that they have something to eat when the apples aren't in bloom.
Yeah. What are some of the best native plants for, let's take the home landscape, and why do you like those in particular? The ones that you, I'm sorry, I asked you two questions at once, and that's not a good, that's never a good thing to do. How about some of the best native trees for a home landscape?
Okay, well, I used to recommend ash, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Now I would recommend a variety of trees depending on the soils, mostly, and the sun conditions. So something that might be used to replace where you might have put an ash would be hackberry. Mm-hmm. Which has nice yellow fall color, has very interesting bark. It might tend to sucker a little bit more than people would like, but if you're mowing the lawn, that's not an issue. But in the woods, it does spread. It doesn't sucker like a sumac suckers, but it will pop up another trunk a little ways away. Hickories are nice. People refrain from planting oaks, but the white oak family is not as susceptible to the disease as the black oak family, so bur oaks and white oaks and swamp white oaks are really nice choices. Swamp white oaks in particular are quite lovely trees. There's one on the UW campus sort of near Babcock Hall.
Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful tree.
It's a great tree. And then there's some trees that we don't think about very much, like Kentucky coffee trees and well, black gum, Nyssa sativa, Tupelo is another name for it. It's a wide-spreading tree at the base as opposed to the top. So it's a little bit difficult in the home landscape where you don't have a lot of space.
Yeah.
River birches are nice in the home landscape, and they're not as susceptible to bronze birch borer as the white birch. So they're a nice choice. I tend not to want to recommend maples if they're in an exposed situation. If you look at the bark of a maple tree versus an oak tree, maple trees have a soft-looking bark.
Yeah.
They're forest tree, and they cannot tolerate really the conditions that you would have on a south-facing front yard because there's no forest around them. And their bark splits in the winter because it gets warmed up by the sun and then the sap freezes at night and it messes up the bark. So maples aren't necessarily a good choice unless you already have shade and want to underplant maples, or you have shade from buildings or something that mm-hmm. are going to give you an opportunity to plant a shade-loving tree.
Talking today with Molly Fifield-Murray about native plants in our landscape and sustainable gardening with native plants, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. And, of course, we always love to hear from you. Pam in Kellogg, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering when the seeds to the butterfly weed are ready.
Well, the rule of thumb is about a month after they bloom, but sometimes sometimes you can see them in seed and blooming at the same time. But with milkweeds, it's fairly easy to tell when the pod is about to split or does split. The seeds don't all blow out at the same time, so when you see the pod starting to become less green and get sort of a dark seam, then you can start to collect them.
And are they pretty easy to start? Would I start those in the spring?
Are you talking about starting them outside or in a...
Probably inside. I mean, natively, they would grow right when they split, but if I gathered the seed, would I start them in the spring?
Well, most native seeds that are ripening this time of year need a winter.
Okay.
So you either need to just sow them outside now where you want them to be and let them go through winter, or if you're going to collect them and take them inside, let them dry, probably in a paper bag that you hang somewhere so you don't get critters eating them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in perhaps February or so, you would put them in the refrigerator with perhaps some damp sand and keep them there for maybe 60 days and then plant them in a pot and
okay.
see what happens.
Well, I've seen them all over for so many years, and I said, this is the year I need to get some in my yard.
Yes, they're beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Pam. Bill in Twin Lakes, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I kind of wanted to counterpoint a couple of things and add a little bit of clarity to the emerald ash borer process. Your guest had mentioned something about putting a product on the trees that is deadly to bumblebees. The majority of the treatments that treat for emerald ash borer that prevent the insect from invading are actually a systemic product that gets inside the plant. It's not something that is applied to the plant and therefore is not subject to drift and has very little, if any, threat to the bumblebee population. And I understand that, you know, we're going to have to replace some of the ash trees and whatnot, but I think that protecting them is very important because there are trees that you can use to replace them, but there is nothing that grows anywhere like an ash tree will. It'll grow in sand, it'll grow in loam, it'll grow in clay, it'll grow on a parkway, it grows fast. And although hackberries and other trees are very pretty with their yellow colors, you cannot beat the maroon, the orange, and the purple that you get from ash trees. And I hate to hear anybody discourage people from treating their ash trees. I mean, this is a very viable plant that's necessary in the environment. I think people need to be encouraged to treat them.
Well, I'm going to beg to differ. It can be an inoculation. It is sometimes also applied to the root systems. And I don't want to use the chemical or the brand name particularly, but it is a systemic, you are correct, it's a systemic insecticide. It is a very dangerous insecticide to insects, which is why it would work on the emerald ash borer, but would also work on any other insect that is near that ash tree. And I think we just need to think really carefully about putting a chemical that is that powerful into the environment when we know that if it is misused, it is deadly. And we cannot afford to lose 25,000 bumblebees in a day very often and survive as a civilization, because the interrelationships between people and nature are so tightly woven that if you look at what you eat and how it's related to pollination by native insects, you might be pretty startled. So it's a very fine line, and I want people to be very cautious. Yes, there's a chemical. Yes, it is systemic. It can be inoculated, but it is very dangerous in the environment.
Talking today with Molly Fifield-Murray about sustainable gardening with native plants. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question for Molly, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org as well, or post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. You have an annual conference.
Yes.
And it's coming up Sunday, September 15th. It's called Native by Design, Gardening for a Sustainable Future. And let's talk about it.
Well, in particular, if people are interested in trees, we have a wonderful arborist, Bruce Allison, coming, and he's offering a workshop on native trees, and that would be a wonderful place to learn what you could use to as alternates for ash trees. Rich Henderson is the keynote speaker talking about prairies and savannas, and there's nobody I'd rather listen to about the prairie and savanna environment than Rich. And he will also talk about adapting that to your home environment. So you can still sign up on the Arboretum website, uwarboretum.org, and get to the conference a week from Sunday.
And we're looking at attracting native pollinators, collecting native seeds. There's all kinds of topics.
Right. We have something for beginners, and we change some of the topics every year. So if you came last year, there's something new for you this year.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the wonderful advantage of offering it right at the Arboretum so people can see the 4 acres of native gardens that are right around the visitor center.
Yeah, and that's great. And if you want to learn some more, you can go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. I've got a link to the Arboretum and the opportunities over there, and that conference again, Sunday, September 15th, Native by Design. We'll probably talk some more about it as the show moves along here. Tom in Muscatine, it's your turn. Thanks for calling, Tom.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I need information, suggestions for planting trees on a boulevard. I have about 6 feet between the row and the sidewalk. It's very sandy soil, and I'm not quite sure what to put in there. I need shade for my yard.
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Well, in a boulevard, you could use something such as shagbark, hickory, sandy soil. You'd be thinking black oaks. Black oaks are susceptible to diseases once again, so that might not be your best choice. I would think also you could try the hackberry in such a situation. Black walnut, if you don't care about growing tomatoes right there, is a possibility, although it does drop nuts, of course. So you're a little bit limited by the sandy soil, which naturally would not necessarily be the best place for trees. People probably would resist planting aspen, for instance, which would be good in sandy soil.
Yeah.
Jack pines, obviously red pines, are possible in sandy soil too, but maybe not in a boulevard. So it's a little bit of a conundrum.
Kathy in Bayfield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have concerns about the very few monarch butterflies that we've seen this summer. Year after year, they've come back and they've just been all over our gardens, and we see them all summer long. I think I've seen five. And I wanted to know what we can do to help reestablish some kinds of corridors from Mexico to Wisconsin and encourage them to breed in Wisconsin so we can help reestablish them.
Well, that's a very good point. It's a little bit sad to see so few butterflies of any kind this year. Last year's drought and the droughts in the central part of the country through which some of these species migrate have been very damaging to them. Milkweed and Monarch Waysides and Planting Milkweeds is a national campaign. Monarch Waysides are not just milkweeds, but also the nectaring plants that they need for food on their way south or their way north in the spring. So planting milkweeds are not hard. Well, some of the milkweeds are very hard to go, and they're very rare. There are very many species, but some of the milkweeds, common milkweed, is not hard to grow, and one of its reasons it's diminished is because of how cleanly we farm these days. We don't have fence rows with milkweed in them anymore. So planting them along roadsides or in parks, or we've encouraged schools to have monarch waysides, and that really helps. You can go online for monarch wayside information. Search for that. And for planting, the common milkweed seeds are very available, as are what some people are calling red milkweed. We used to call marsh milkweed, but it doesn't only grow on marshes. It's a beautiful plant. And, of course, the butterfly weed we've talked about. There's a milkweed for sandy soils called world milkweed. It has very fine leaves, but monarchs still use that also. In the fall, you need to have some of the goldenrods and asters. New England asters attractives. Showy goldenrod seems to attract a lot of butterflies. I've seen it covered with butterflies and bees late into the season. And right now, a lot of the butterflies are going to native thistles, which also get a bad rap because of non-native aggressive thistles, but the native thistles are not aggressive. And they're also on a lot of the sunflowers, the native sunflowers. So a variety is good, and the milkweeds are essential for the larva, as you know.
May I ask one more question?
Sure.
I want to know if milkweed is considered a noxious weed in Wisconsin, if that's something that you can answer.
I don't think it's considered a noxious weed.
No, it is not.
No.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Glendadine in Lyons, it is your turn. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi. I don't know if you talked about this already, because I just turned the radio on a short time ago. But my husband and I live in Lyons in a very, very wooded area. And just recently, the last week, we discovered these trees that are all covered with like red berries, and it's like a cluster. It's not like a like not individual berries. And we have lived there for 14 years, and we've never ever seen these before. And I took a sample to the Pleasant Prairie Extension, and she called me and told me that it was prickly ash, and she said they haven't seen very much of it around here, and I'm just wondering how rare it is. She said that it's very good for butterflies. Butterflies love it. And I'm wondering how big the trees actually get, because right now there are tons of them all over in the woods, and they're just small around, you know. And I'm just wondering, do they get to be big trees, or are they just kind of like more like bush type things?
Well, your description sounded more like sumac to me than prickly ash, but if it's prickly ash, it is very popular with butterflies. It's a larval food for some of the swallowtails. A lot of people get rid of it because it forms a clone and it has thorns, but it's a native shrub that you would naturally sort of find on hillsides or invading a field, and if you can stand to leave it, it would be good to leave it because of its larval potential for the butterflies.
Well, it's absolutely not sumac, because I know what sumac is. These are actually trees, you know, woody trees, and they do have like little thorns on them, and they're just really pretty, you know.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, they won't get any bigger, or the the trunks won't get any bigger?
Well, they do not get to be big trees. No, not anything like an oak. They're an understory. They're more of an invasive, sort of the woods changing the field into an area that trees can survive. So they're sort of pioneer trees, like sumac okay. is or aspen is.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Vincent and Racine, let's go to you now. Hi, Vincent.
Hi. For years, I've been trying to grow walnut trees from the nuts, and I either stick them in the ground or pots, and I have never been successful in getting a tree to sprout, a nut to sprout. What am I doing wrong? And I have another question. How can I tell when a nut is dried out and won't sprout?
Well, I think if it's too dry, you'll be able to just tell that because it's very dry. But walnuts have a very large defense mechanism. So you have the outer shell, and then once you're inside that, there's another shell. And yeah. to get them to germinate, it's probably best to let the squirrels work on them and open up all of that. Or you can do it yourself. Taking off the outer hull tends to get your hands pretty stained.
Yeah.
And then water needs to penetrate the inner hole. If you crack that open at the wrong time, I suspect that you would be disturbing it. So you would need to take off the outer hole and then plant the inner hole without getting all the way into the seed.
Yes. Well, I've done that, and I still don't get any results. I don't know. Well, maybe the nut is dried out. I don't know.
Are you trying to get them in a very specific place?
No. I plant them various places, and I also put them in pots. I thought maybe putting them in pots. Is there any time of the year when it's good? Should I do it right after they drop from the tree, or can I do it in the spring?
Well, they need to overwinter, and so they need cold, very cold temperatures in the winter. You need to let them, these are designed to have the outer holes removed by animals and the inner holes scratched so that water can penetrate. So you have to sort of mimic what a squirrel would do, or let the squirrels do it yeah. if you don't care where it's going to go. I've never seen, walnuts pop up mostly where you don't want them.
Yeah.
So I'm a little puzzled that you're having trouble, but I suspect that you're either getting too far into where the embryo is or not far enough. So when something has a seed has a hard shell, you need to scratch it so water can penetrate it.
Oh, okay.
There you
well,
go.
That I haven't been doing.
Okay.
Well, that's something you
they
need
might
to
come
do.
Up eventually.
Thanks, Vince. Thank you very much for calling. Sort of a related kind of thing here on Facebook from Emily, who was wondering if you know anything about planting locust trees from seed. She says, my parents have a couple of trees, and they have, of course, thousands of pods. And she thought it'd be fun activity for her five-year-old.
Yes. Well, the pods, once again, you have to remove the seed from the pod, let it overwinter. A lot of these things you can get the answers for very specifically by searching on the web if you are able. People have done studies of how to grow all of these seeds, particularly paying attention to how much winter they need. So in prairie planting, for instance, you'll see some seeds, if they are mature in the spring, don't need a winter before they germinate. Something like lupin will germinate the minute you plant it, if you plant it right away after you collect it, because it's ripe in before 4th of July, say.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that's getting ripe after 4th of July needs a winter to germinate. It's either a mechanical thing with breaking up of the hard husk around the outside, or it's a chemical thing that requires the cold treatment. And so if you look at the nursery catalogs, they will say this seed needs 10 days of cold or 60 days of cold, whatever it is. And sometimes that's cold and wet. With the locust, I don't know particularly, but it does have, it's a legume, and then it has a hard seed inside. So most times with legumes, you need to scratch that hard outer seed coat. but it does need to go through cold temperatures.
Oh. We had another Facebook question from Jerry, who has 6 moonflowers. They have beautiful, long, white, trumpeted flowers. The prickly-looking seeds are forming. Wondering about saving the seeds for next year and how to plant them, or when and how to plant them in spring.
I don't know moonflower, so I'm guessing it's just something I've forgotten, or it's not native.
And you know what? Moonflower reminded me, for some reason, of a flower that I learned about, my wife and I learned about, when we were in Door County last week. We were waiting for a table at a restaurant, the Wild Tomato in Fish Creek, and got talking with 2 sisters. And we're talking plants, and they have Judy and Carol, and they happened to, Judy had purchased a popcorn cassia. And it is, she ran to the car and brought it out for us to look at. And it's a beautiful flower, but look, it's a zone 14-15, so it's obviously a houseplant for us. But you crush the leaf of it a little bit, of one of the leaves, and it smells just like buttered popcorn.
Oh.
Oh, we had a marvelous time talking about that. Obviously, not a native plant, but popcorn cassia was really a fun plant to see and something you'd put in your house probably here.
Right. There are lots of things that are very lovely and can be grown as an annual,
mm-hmm.
or need to be in the house.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really fun talking with Judy and Carol, for sure. Benji in Cumberland, your turn. Hi, Benji.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I love the show. I was really sympathetic to your speaker's concern about the biocides use on the emerald ash borer. In our suburban Chicago home, we had a fantastic tree that's being hit hard by it, and I did a pretty careful scientific literature search, and I was looking just at the scientific papers from the agricultural land grant colleges and things, and in the last 2 years or so, there's a new chemical out. It's the one based on fermented fungus and stuff. And, while it is quite tricky to use, it can only be used by professionals. We had our tree treated, and I swear it changed colors in about 3 days to finally look healthy. And the thing is, it's pretty expensive for a single person, but we also got worked with our town to get several thousand trees treated, and you can drop the cost dramatically. It has had no effect at all on our bumblebee population in our yard, and we're very concerned about that, and I appreciate the speaker's concerned about that population, but I'd really take strong exception with this sense that there's nothing you can do, that there appears to be one chemical out of about 8 that are used, one chemical that is injected in the tree, it has profound and lasting effect, and if you use it, and if it's used systematically, like in an area, it may be possible to change the emerald ash borer population and preserve whole areas of trees. And I just want to say that the book isn't closed on that, and I take exception to the fact that the speaker tends to say there's little you can do. There's this one chemical in particular, and the scientific literature backs it up strongly, appears to be very, very effective and doesn't hurt the insect population. But again, it has to be handled only by professionals.
Did you know the name of the chemical you're referring to, Ben?
Oh, it's your organic chemistry. It's only about 16 or 18 syllables. Triage is the brand name. And it's got a T-R-E-A with a double dot over it, A-G-E, I think. But it's the actual chemical is, an IUPAC chemical of about 18 or 20 syllables.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate people's concerns about their trees, and I think it's very good that this person looked into the scientific literature, which I would say is mixed, and I think you need to look very carefully at who's supporting the research.
Mm-hmm.
Because you will get the chemical company, and I'm not questioning the caller,
mm-hmm.
but the chemicals that were applied when the 25,000 bumblebees were killed in Oregon were applied by professionals. So just because they're being applied by professionals doesn't mean they're going to be applied correctly. I know that Phil Pelletieri, who's on this show frequently, would recommend an inoculation. I don't know this particular chemical that this person is mentioning, but a lot of them are nicotinoids, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and they are very, very dangerous to pollinators. So if you're looking into that and being very careful about it, and realize that in my understanding that you have to apply these chemicals every single year, and maybe the caller has different information on that, but from what I know, you have to apply them every year. So maybe it's $100 a tree and you think, well, this is a special tree to me, I can afford this, but it's $100 a tree every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had it about $100 per year. And in the got it to about $6 a tree or less.
Yeah. That's by having the whole community, a whole community of trees. Well, an interesting topic, that's for sure. Probably one that we'll be dealing with over time more than once. Thanks a lot, Benji, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give some others a chance to join in here. What about you? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Terry in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Yes, hi. I'd like to ask Molly two questions, please. One is, I've got an American elm looking good, still alive.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I know. I've got three of them on my property.
Wow.
Right now. Anyhow, the American elm, roughly a foot, a little over a foot in diameter. Same thing with the black walnut. They're roughly about 40 feet apart. Will I ever have any effect of the black walnut being so close to the American elm? You know, with the roots and the juggling and all that other.
I don't think that elm, I can't swear to this, but I don't think the elm would be affected by the juggling if it's that far away. When the canopy, you know, the
canopies are going to overlap.
The chemical will go out to the edge of the canopy. And if you want to protect the elm, gee, I'd hate to tell you to take down a walnut. They grow together in the wild. They're both in the plant community. You know, the elms came from sort of wet forests, as did the honey locusts. That's one reason why they were so good along streets, because they suffocate along streets, just like they suffocated in a bottomland forest in the spring, for instance, when it's flooded. That's why they're good along roads and places where they get trampled and the air gets pushed out. The walnut can be not in really wet ground, but nearby. But the juglans will be in the root system out to the edge of the crown. You also could get some effects of shading from the walnut, but not necessarily just the juglans. I'd have to look it up, frankly, to be sure. Mostly when people are asking about the juglans tolerance, it's for under story, you know, the ground layer plants.
Mm-hmm.
One more question, please.
Okay.
Now, we're talking trees. How about the ironwood, a good tree to plant? And
yeah.
I think you have to have a higher acidic soil for ironwood. Is that true?
I'm not sure about the acidity. And ironwood is a forest understory tree, but it can tolerate partial sun. It's a little bit slower growing than some things, but it's a very pretty tree, Australia. There's also musselwood that grows up north that's also more of a shade-tolerant tree.
We were doing some hiking in Peninsula State Park here a week or so ago, Labor Day weekend, and there's some beautiful ironwood trees in that park.
Yes, you mostly see them in the woods.
Yeah.
In the shade of taller trees.
Yeah.
They can get very tall, but it takes them a long time. I mostly think of them as, you know, the second layer down.
Yep.
Yeah. So then, Molly, you would say a little bit more if I put them out in an open field, not a good location.
Well, the ironwood would do better than the musselwood, of course, because it has a tougher bark. But that's not its natural condition out in the open.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Dennis in Fort Atkinson. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for taking my call. When we lived in town, we had a beautiful horse chestnut tree, and we moved out into the country, and we're trying to get some of the seeds to germinate. And a similar problem to one of your previous callers, where I try almost everything I can think of, but I still can't seem to get them to germinate. Any ideas?
Well, once again, you're talking about something with a very hard shell. And you need to penetrate the shell for so water can get in there to help the embryo germinate, but not destroy the embryo. So what some people use, and this would go back to the honey locust and some of the other things we've talked about, some people use sandpaper to scratch the shell and get the water in for germination.
Oh, sandpaper's not a bad idea. Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dennis. Thank you very much for calling. Molly Fifield Murray, our guest today. She is the Outreach and Education Manager at the UW Arboretum. She's been doing that for over 20 years now. Trained landscape restoration and native garden expert. Great to have her with us here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look today at sustainable gardening with native plants, our guest Molly Fifield Murray from the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. Great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo or a question on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. Jeff in Wausau. It's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. I've always wondered why oak trees can produce just tremendously one year, and then the next year there's absolutely nothing happening. Can you give me a little information on how that works?
Well, I've noticed that a lot of plants are producing a lot of fruit this year because they didn't last year. So oaks... The acorns dropping from bur oaks this year is just tremendous. You can hardly walk under them. You're on rollers. And the plums and the apple, wild apples and the hawthorns are just full of fruit and sometimes breaking because there's so much fruit. But in the oaks, one of the families of oaks only produces acorns every other year to a high number. Now, they're not always synced. So you might have one black oak producing this year and a different black oak producing next year. But sometimes it seems like they're all doing the same thing. And with weather, particularly last year's drought, really, really affected fruit production, both in the fall because it was dry, but also in the spring. Spring was so early last year that some things were out of sync and some things formed flowers early and then they got frozen. And so, you know, the apple production was way down and the same thing is happening to the native trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was surprising because last year with the amount of drought we had, my oak trees were just, they produced like tremendously.
Wow.
and that was kind of the weird thing. But I guess, do they need to be pollinated?
Yes, oaks are wind pollinated.
Okay.
So when you see them in the spring, you'll see the male flowers are yellow. Well, they sort of look like pipe cleaners hanging down, not that long, but limp.
Yep.
And the pollen blows to the female flowers. So.
Okay.
And when they're under a lot of stress.
Well, sometimes people say plants put out a lot of seed because they think they're going to die and this is their last chance. I don't think we know everything about them. And as you know, have noticed in your own woods that certain oaks don't produce acorns every year in a certain family. And I'm sorry, off the top, we were just talking about this yesterday at the Arboretum, and I didn't look up whether it's the black oak family or the white oak family that only produces on alternate years.
Hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Jeff. Appreciate it. Tim in Fairchild, on to you now. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I listen to you all the time. I just had a comment. You were talking about ironwood just a little bit ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up in the country on a farm, we'd have some ironwood undergrowth, like your guest had said, and we didn't cut very much of it, but once in a while we would. And you can understand why it was called ironwood.
Oh, yeah.
If you take a chainsaw to it, sparks would fly off the chain, almost like cutting into a piece of steel.
Hmm. I'm not seeing the sparking. That's pretty interesting.
And if you burned it, like in the fireplace, which we had, you didn't want to put very much in there because it would burn so hot, it would just about melt anything that you put it into.
Wow. It must have a lot of carbon in it.
I'm not sure. And it was small. You know, it was undergrowth, and it was only maybe, 2-3 inches in diameter. We didn't cut much of it, but I just had to call in because I'd heard your comment about ironwood, and it's you can understand why it's called ironwood.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing it.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
I did look up a little more information on the ironwood. It can grow in the sun. Its maximum height is about 35 feet as compared to a maple or something that would get to 100 feet. So it is an understory tree, but it can tolerate sun. And for the person who was looking for sand, it can tolerate sandy soil also, and it's attractive to butterflies. It's also tolerant of clay, so it's a versatile tree, probably not planted as much as some others because of its relatively slow growth, but you get a nicely formed tree after a few years.
And thanks again, Tim, for calling. And just taking a look at my Facebook page again, we had a note from Mary Lynn, who said, for those interested in the popcorn plant that we were just talking about earlier that Judy bought up in Door County, there are some great examples of popcorn cassia at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. Hadn't thought of that, but sure, they have one example in the touch and smell bed in the herb garden.
Okay.
So if you want to, you're in the Madison area, that's one place where you can probably go and see and smell the popcorn plant.
You know, another thing that smells like popcorn is prairie drop seed when it's in seed. I don't know if we think it smells like popcorn or the butter we put on popcorn, but it's a fairly delicious fragrance. This summer, the drop seed and the Monarda or the bee balm were blooming together, and so you had this mint with buttery popcorn flavor the minute you stepped out of the building at the Arboretum. It was quite wonderful.
Quite wonderful. Anne in Madison, hello.
Hi. I have a follow-up comment for the fellow who wanted to plant horse chestnuts.
Okay.
I wanted to let you know that I was successful with a couple of them. I've got one in my yard right now. What I did was put it in the refrigerator with a little bit of water for a few weeks or so, and just similar to what you do with acorns. And they came up they rooted just fine.
Oh, great.
In the water.
So several weeks you put them in?
A few weeks, yeah.
A few weeks.
Yes. So you're giving them both the cold treatment and the moisture that will penetrate the outer shell.
Right.
Yes.
Well, that's a great idea. Certainly worth a try. Thanks,
yes.
Anne.
And horse chestnuts, while not native in this part of the country or not native in Wisconsin, are doing very well at Longenecker Gardens, and they have beautiful flowers, once again visited by butterflies and bees.
Yeah. Thanks,
Fortunately,
Anne.
Fortunately, they seems to grow awfully slow, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're...
Now, I gathered them from a couple trees on the university, so...
Yeah, cool. There you go. Thanks, Anne. Yeah, you may not be around to see them 50 feet tall.
No.
that's for sure. Luann in Madison. Hi, Luann.
Hi. I have a question about a burning bush shrub. We have it planted in a naturalized area, and I thought that I had heard that they were on the list to be declared an invasive type plant. Is that true?
Well, the non-native euonymus, yes, that is true.
Okay.
And they are they will spread into our native woodlands. There is a native euonymus, Euonymus atropurpurea, or eastern wahoo, that is not an invasive species. It might be not as readily available at some garden centers, but you should be able to find them at good nurseries that grow their own plants. So something like Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls, mm-hmm. I guess yeah. that's where they are.
Well, yeah, we got this a number of years ago in Madison, so I'm assuming it's not the one that you're talking about. So my question was then, I probably should cut it down.
Well, we have recommended to people that if you have something in your garden that has the potential for being invasive in native woodlands, that yes, you remove it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to know. I don't want to be contributing where I shouldn't be.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Luann.
Thanks for
lot.
Asking that.
Yeah, you bet. Harriet in Muscadet. Hello.
Hi. I have a quick question. I have some bushes along one of our paths on our farm, and I noticed that they have white berries, and the berries are a quarter to three-eighths of an inch in diameter, and they're intermixed among the prickly ash. The stems are, or the trunks are probably an inch to an inch and a half, and I've never noticed the white berries before. Do you have any idea what it is?
Well, what has white berries right now in the native woodland edge or where the woods is invading a field is gray dogwood. The leaves will start to turn a little bit purple also. The white berries are one of the most nutritious snacks for migrating birds. They have a lot of carbohydrates in them, and so they don't last very long once the migrating birds come through. I've seen gray dogwoods with bluebirds and white-throated sparrows and white-crowned sparrows all over them getting these berries and, you know, intermixed with the chipmunks and the squirrels. So they're one of the best plants to have for migrating birds. They do tend to spread, as you'll notice out along your farm there, that they don't stay confined. So they're not always used in town, but they're a wonderful wildlife plant.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, thanks so yep. much for the information.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Dave in Janesville, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I've got some 20-plus-year-old quaking aspen. I'm wondering when the best time would be to cut them down and treat the trunk to eliminate suckers in the yard as well as the prairie.
Well, quaking aspen's just doing its job there, but of course we don't want to have it do its job, which is to create the conditions for a forest. One of the trouble with a lot of these native plants that have suckering ability to invade open land is that when you cut them, they just produce more suckers. So if you cut sumac, you'll immediately have new sumac popping up along every root node, unless you do treat them. Treating or cut them multiple times. So the way to stimulate an aspen grove is to cut it without treating it. And as to when you can do it, you know, you need to follow the directions on the chemicals you're using. Certain of the chemicals that we use on woody plants cannot be used at certain temperatures and can't be used when there's snow, etc., and others can be used at different temperatures than. So there's some of the chemicals, for instance, in the Garland family that are used on woody plants have a wider range of ability to be used at different times of year, and you don't have to wait for a certain time. Some of these chemicals can be used in the winter when the plant is not actively growing, unlike some of the chemicals that you use on herbaceous plants that have to be applied when they're green and actively growing.
Yeah.
So we have started working on woody plants at the Arboretum after a spring and early summer's worth of working on herbaceous plants, and now we switch into working on woody plants about now and go on to probably about March where we would be actually switching back to the herbaceous plants again.
See, is there an optimal time, say, between now and winter where the carbohydrates are going back into the soil, or just any time?
Well, when a plant's actively growing, it's transporting, you know, phloem down the river. It's transporting down into the roots. And when it's senescing and not actively growing, it's still, as it's losing its leaves, it's drawing down into the roots, so that's not a bad time. But some of these chemicals can be used in the winter, too, even though the plant is not actively growing.
And thanks very much, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today, Molly Fifield-Murray. She's been the Outreach and Education Manager at the Arboretum at UW for 21 years, trained in landscape restoration and native gardening, and she's taught about and designed native wildflower gardens. And she was telling us about the Native Plant Arboretum Conference coming up September 15th at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Lots of great information for you at that conference, and I hope you'll take a look at it on the website. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Native plants make so much sense in a garden. They're beautiful to look at. They come back year after year. They can stand extremes of our climate, whatever it throws at them. And they don't emerge completely unscathed from droughts like last year, but they certainly seem to have bounced back more quickly than a lot of our non-natives. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us for this edition of Garden Talk, visiting today with Molly Fifield-Murray, our Outreach and Education Manager for the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison. Always has great information to share about using native plants effectively. And Molly, of course, always great to have you with us.
Oh, it's so much fun to talk with you and your guests.
We have lots of callers online already. Let me give the number. There's one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions. Ken in Mayville has a comment. It's been waiting a while, so let's go there. Hi, Ken. Thanks for calling.
How you doing? I used to heat with ironwood. That's all I burned in my wood stove for years. I harvested off of about 80 acres of forest, a lot of ironwood in there. I would not plant one near a house. They seem to be very susceptible to blowdown. Very rarely had to cut them down. They usually were blown down in a storm. You can push them over fairly easily. They seem to have very shallow roots. They don't. The ones that I harvested, most of them were under a foot across. Very rarely do you find them a foot or more. And usually when they get bigger, the base of the trunk is hollow. So they're actually kind of easy to cut up and everything. And when you do cut with a chainsaw, make sure you have plenty of chains because they will dull your saw real fast.
Good points, Ken. Thanks a lot for calling. More on the ironwood.
Yes.
You never know what we're gonna have on the show. And it's fun to hear all this about ironwood, especially having seen some really nice specimens just a week ago.
Well, you know, and the root system allows it to grow on those steep ravines where you often see it in the Baraboo Hills or, as you said, up in Door County. The root system, not being a taproot, does spread out and it would probably... I've not seen them blow over as much as this fellow, so I wonder what's underneath his soil, but it does allow them to grow on that shallow soil in the ravines.
Judy in Wind Lake, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a maple in my backyard, and there's a seedling that's about 3 feet tall, and I'm just going to transplant it next year, but the seedling has powdery mildew all over it. Is that considered a reject?
Well, powdery mildew is frequently on maple leaves and leaves of other plants that are in somewhat shady situations, and the sapling or seedling underneath the other trees would be in shade, probably not getting as much air circulation. It does not kill the plants. It's unsightly, but it's not something that would necessarily make you reject that plant. And if you move the plant and it has a little more air circulation, it might not get the powdery mildew in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And on to Gary in Ashland. Hi, Gary.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Had a couple things. I've got some bee balm plants and some coneflower, and I should have, they just sprouted so much, the bed is so full of them. I'd like to move some to a different bed. What's a good time to do that?
Well, if you could mark them or leave the stem standing so you can find them and do it after they've lost their leaves, that's the best time for the plant to move it. And if you can mulch it after you've moved it so that it's not going to get tossed out of the ground by freezing and thawing. You could also move them in the spring if you can still find them, if the stems haven't been mowed off or burned off or whatever. You can move them in the before they are starting to come up in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, two other questions. There's so many grasshoppers this year. How do I get rid of those?
It's the plague. No, I don't know. They'll go with the winter, and we never know what the weather is going to do and how it's going to affect the insects and the plants. And so them being a problem this year doesn't mean that they'll be a problem next year. In fact, an interesting thing I learned from Dr. Charles Bomar at UW-Stout, who's a grasshopper expert, is that the grasshopper that we read about in, say, the Little House on the Prairie books that was the plague to the wheat farmers is now extinct.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, there's so many of them. I don't know what kind of hawk it was, but it had yellow legs and yellow beak, and it had the plumage was brown with some white in it, and it sat out in my yard here for 4 or 5 hours just flying from one little place to the next eating the grasshoppers.
Yeah, well, that must have been fun to watch. Kestrels?
Yeah, it was.
I've seen northern shrikes with grasshoppers in their mouths and the kestrels and even a red tail might get them, or some of the larger hawks if they're just right there.
Yeah,
absolutely. This is bigger than a kestrel.
Okay.
Very cool.
Anyway, one last inquiry. What's a good bush, a berry bush for wildlife?
Well, there's quite a few to choose from. If you're talking about not very tall, I mentioned the gray dogwoods earlier, and they would grow up where you are. Also, if you don't mind a small tree or a shrubby tree, the Juneberry or the Amelanchier group of species is very attractive to wildlife in the spring. Oaks and black cherries are trees that are quite useful for wildlife over winter, as are aspen, very good for wildlife. But if we're going back to shrubs, there's quite a few to choose from. Not only the gray dogwood, but ninebark, physocarpus, elderberries for berries right now. And they were very prolific this year. Also, a lot of things that produced not much last year, producing more this year. The wild crabapple, if you want a medium size. Nannyberry, which is one of the viburnums, Viburnum lentigo, also has dark berries that are good for wildlife.
Which one was that?
Nannyberry, Viburnum lentigo.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Gary, for calling. And Mary in Heartland, hello.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have an invasive species question. I may have it in my woods. I read about it in the journal probably maybe a month ago. They said it was a ferny leaf, and it gets a sticker in the fall. And I had those starting to come up because I took out all the garlic mustard like I should.
Yeah.
And then I started to get this other thing. I thought, oh, nice. It smells like an anise in a way,
mm-hmm.
or licorice. And now I read that description in the journal, and I'm wondering if I'm supposed to pull that all out now or if it's something else. Or
Does it have a long seed that has two points on it that sort of sticks in?
No, it's a black seed, kind of a crescent shaped, and the whole thing will stick onto you.
Okay.
And it makes a lot of them.
Okay. It might be, I'm not sure, but it might be Japanese hedge parsley. At first, when you said the anise scent, I was thinking it was the native sweet Sicily or something similar. But if it doesn't have a long seed with points on it, a sticker kind of seed, then it might be the Japanese hedge parsley, which has ferny kind of leaves, white flowers. A little bit like a spread out and tinier yarrow or Queen Anne's lace kind of flower in that group.
And could be. Yeah,
and yes, that is a relatively new invasive.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Just what I needed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, okay, I'll maybe do a little bit more research on that. I don't know what I did with the article, but that'll help.
You can check online or check with your local extension agent, and the DNR has a really good website for invasive species.
Oh, they do.
And you can just go to Wisconsin, search for Wisconsin invasive species, and you'll get to their website, and they'll give you not only what to look for, but in most cases, how to deal with it.
Wonderful. I'll do that then. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks a lot for calling. Chris in Oregon. Hi.
Hello. Hello. Hello to Molly and Larry.
Hi.
I have a question about spiderwort.
Yes.
I have it in my garden, and I would like to move it to my prairie because when it dies back, it gets so straggly looking. And so I'd like to put it in my prairie. And I know where it is, but it's all dead right now. Can I move it, just its roots, and put it in the prairie now?
Yes.
I can. And is there a spot, does it like it more dry or more moist, or does it have a preference?
More dry than more moist. It can be in very dry prairies and in mesic prairies, not as much in very moist prairies.
Okay.
And the seeds are quite fascinating, but of course they're hard to collect because the flowers come into bloom every day, one at a time. And so some of the seed is ripe when it's still flowering.
Okay. Oh, but now mine is completely dormant, and I don't see any of it. And no, in past falls, it comes back a little bit. I get a few leaves, but I can just move the dormant roots.
Yes.
And it should be okay?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
And thanks a lot for calling. And you can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here as we talk native plants with Molly Fifield-Murray of the UW Arboretum. 1-800-642-1234. Jolie in Mosinee, thank you for calling.
Hello. What I'm calling about is, when is the best time to prune lilac bushes?
Okay, well, lilacs are not native, but we have an incredible lilac collection at the Arboretum. If you haven't seen it in the spring,
it's wonderful.
You should come on over. Whenever the lilacs are blooming, last year it was a month earlier than normal, and this year it was a week later than normal. But pruning them, some people say to cut off the flowers after, sort of deadhead the flowers. And some people even say to cut the branches down after blooming. But at the Arboretum, we prune them in the dormant season. And the way you prune them is to cut down no more than a third of the very largest stems clear to the ground. Because then they will send up new suckers that will bloom lower to the ground. If you just cut off the flowers at the top, then they keep getting taller and the flowers get farther away from you.
So you're saying the dormant time, so would that be, so I could trim them this fall, later fall?
Yes, after the leaves come down.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Thank you. Oh, and then here's another one, potentillas.
Well, potentillas are a summer blooming shrub, and so you sort of continually prune them so they keep producing flowers.
Okay. Yep. But I could trim those two again in the fall.
Yep.
Yes. Okay. Or right now, for that matter. But you, it's getting late to try to stimulate more flowers. So you might, you can even probably wait till spring.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jean in Big Bend. Hello.
Good afternoon. I have a yellow poplar tree that's about maybe 5-6 years old. I got it with one of those package deals from the Arbor Foundation. And it's now really looks pretty healthy, although I know it's not native to this area. But I have some pretty low branches, and if the tree is going to grow, those branches I wouldn't want. And I want to know, what about pruning them?
Okay, so yellow poplar is sometimes called tulip tree by folks. It's native in the south of here a little bit. It probably will do well here. We have some in the arboretum that are so tall that you can't see the tulips when they bloom up at the top of the tree. It's a tall forest tree. Pruning them is important to wait until the fall or dormant season. And don't do it in the spring, so do it in the fall or late fall. And when you're pruning trees, you need to look for how the branch meets either the other branch or the trunk, because trees have a collar where the branch comes off of a trunk, and you don't want to cut in past the collar too close to the trunk. The collar has specialized cells for forming the, you know, basically the scab over the wound. And so you want to be just on the outside of the collar when you prune it late fall.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for this advice.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling.
Just one other quick thing about pruning is that a horizontal, you know, almost a 90-degree branch is the strongest branch, the weakest branch is a narrow V. So when you're looking at your tree for pruning, and you're trying to decide which ones to take off any that are going to rub each other first, because that will open the tree for disease, and then take off the narrow V kind of branches next, and then see if you need to take off any horizontal branches.
Mm-hmm. There you
go.
Thank
you very much.
Yep, thanks, Gene, for calling. I had a question. Actually, James had a question about bur oaks, wondering if he could... he's got a branching out on a bur oak about 3 feet from the ground. Wondered if he could remove that or one of the branches without damaging the tree at least.
Yes, but you need to wait until November at least.
Yep.
If the weather has gotten cold by then and insects aren't around, and then the tree, if you prune it outside of that collar I was just talking about, the tree can form the callus before bugs are around in the spring, and it won't get infected by some of the insects that would carry oak wilt.
Yep.
Bur oaks can isolate oak wilt mostly, but you don't want to open it up to the disease.
Deborah in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. About two or three months ago, I saw a tree. I wasn't sure what it was, and then I identified it when I got home as a horse chestnut, and it was very young, and it had yellow blossoms, beautiful blossoms with red, like, speckling towards the inside. And I actually was about to leave, and a hummingbird came up to it. And so I broke off a leaf and took four of the flowers, and now I flatten them. And I mean, that was to identify it, and then I flattened them in a book, and actually it wouldn't fit in a book, I pressed it, and now the flowers are they seem like they're seeds, but I'm wondering, would the flowers go to seed if even after they've been removed from the mother tree? And do you think I'd be able to plant one?
Well, in some plants, particularly herbaceous plants, there will be, after ripening, for instance, dandelions are notorious for the seeds after ripening, after the flower has been cut off. But horse chestnuts are very big. If you think of Ohio buckeye, that's sort of what the horse chestnut seed looks like. It's maybe an inch in diameter. So you probably don't have any of those with your pressed flowers.
Yeah, maybe it was an Ohio buckeye.
Well, you might have, what you might have is either pollen or just some of the dried flower part.
It's hardened, though. So, but, I don't have the correct book with me to look it up. I had it, but I have several books, and it's not in the one I'm looking at now. But so does that sound familiar to you?
Well, horse chestnuts do have flowers like you described, and hummingbirds do come to them, but they do have very large seeds.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. We had an email from Linda, who has a cabin in Boulder Junction area, and they're working to expand the buffer by the lake, and is wondering if it's too late to plant native thistles and milkweed. There's still time. Are there types which grow better in sandy soil? And one thing, just in passing, I'd mention, I hope she goes to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, because there's a wonderful photograph of a four-year shoreline recreation project in Waukesha, the Waukesha area, but it's just absolutely beautiful.
Yes, the showy goldenrods in there are wonderful attractants and bloom very late, so you get bees and butterflies on them. It's not too late to plant, but you don't want to plant too late into the fall, particularly if you're getting plugs, because the frost can pop them out of the ground. As surprising as that is, they can just sort of pop out like a cork. Some people like to plant seeds in late fall or, even into December, and then let the snow settle them into the ground, and that tends to be very good for planting the wildflowers, as opposed to the grasses, which prefer to be planted in the warmer time in the spring. So you could plant plants now, but not too much later than within a couple weeks. And you could plant seeds either now, late now. You don't want to plant seeds right now. You don't want them to germinate this fall and then get frozen off. So plant them closer to Thanksgiving time.
Just wanted to mention that Prairie Days is being organized by the Prairie Enthusiast members across three states and 11 chapters for their local communities. It's going on actually this weekend, September 7th and 8th, Saturday and Sunday. And they host field trips and seed collecting and a whole bunch more. And if you just go to the prairieenthusiast.org, and you'll find out, in your area, still time this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, to get involved in that. And then, of course, the annual Arboretum Conference coming up a week from Sunday, actually, so it's September 15th.
Right, and people can sign up online for that through Monday, or the 9th, I think that's Monday.
Yeah, that's Monday. So please go to the Arboretum website, or just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can click right on it and get right to that conference. There's a lot of great information there. And Molly, always a pleasure.
Yep, it's fun, and your callers are great.
Molly Fifield-Murray has been Outreach and Education Manager at the Arboretum for a long, long time. It's always great to have her with us, and she'll be back. We'll do it again. And thank you so much for listening in and for calling, and stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.